This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Mortal Instruments, Book 6, City of Heavenly Fire, by Cassandra Clare. Read by Sophie Turner and Jason Doring.
In God 'tis glory, and when men aspire, 'tis but a spark too much of heavenly fire. John Dryden, Absalom and Achitophel.
Prologue. Fall like rain. The Los Angeles Institute, December 2007. On the day Emma Carstairs' parents were killed, the weather was perfect. On the other hand, the weather was usually perfect in Los Angeles. Emma's mother and father dropped her off on a clear winter morning at the Institute in the hills behind the Pacific Coast Highway, overlooking the blue ocean. The sky was a cloudless expanse that stretched from the cliffs of the Pacific Palisades to the beaches at Point Hume. A report had come in the night before of demonic activity near the beach caves of Leo Carrillo. The Carstairs had been assigned to look into it. Later, Emma would remember her mother tucking a wind-blown strand of hair behind her ear as she offered to draw a fearless rune on Emma's father, and John Carstairs laughing and saying he wasn't sure how he felt about newfangled runes. He was fine with what was written in the Grey Book, thanks very much. At the time, though, Emma was impatient with her parents, hugging them quickly before pulling away to race up the Institute steps, her backpack bouncing between her shoulders as they waved goodbye from the courtyard. Emma loved that she got to train at the Institute. Not only did her best friend Julian live there, but she always felt as if she was flying into the ocean when she went inside it. It was a massive structure of wood and stone at the end of a long pebbled drive that wound through the hills. Every room, every floor looked out over the ocean and the mountains and the sky, rippling expanses of blue and green and gold. Emma's dream was to climb up onto the roof with Jules, though so far they'd been foiled by parents, to see if the view stretched all the way to the desert in the south. The front doors knew her and gave way easily under her familiar touch. The entryway and lower floors of the Institute were full of adult shadow hunters, striding back and forth. Some kind of meeting, Emma guessed. She caught sight of Julian's father, Andrew Blackthorne, the head of the Institute, amid the crowd. Not wanting to be slowed down by greetings, she dashed for the changing room on the second floor, where she swapped her jeans and t-shirt for training clothes. Oversized shirt, loose cotton pants, and the most important item of all, the blade slung over her shoulder. Cortana. The name simply meant short sword, but it wasn't short to Emma. It was the length of her forearm, sparkling metal, the blade inscribed with words that never failed to cause a shiver down her spine. I am Cortana, of the same steel and temper as Joyeuse and Durandal. Her father had explained what it meant when he put the sword in her 10-year-old hands for the first time. You can use this for training until you're 18 when it becomes yours, John Carstairs had said, smiling down at her as her fingers traced the words. Do you understand what that means? She'd shaken her head. Steel, she understood, but not temper. Temper meant anger, something her father was always warning her she should control. What did it have to do with a blade? You know of the Whalen family, he'd said. They were famous weapon makers before the Iron Sisters began to forge all the Shadow Hunter blades. Whalen the Smith made Excalibur and Joyeuse, Arthur's and Lancelot's swords, and Durandal, the sword of the hero Roland. And they made this sword, too, from the same steel. All steel must be tempered, subjected to great heat, almost enough to melt or destroy the metal, to make it stronger. He'd kiss the top of her head. Carstairs have carried this sword for generations. The inscription reminds us that Shadow Hunters are the angels' weapons. Temper us in the fire and we grow stronger. When we suffer, we survive. Emma could hardly wait the 6 years until she would be 18, when she could travel the world to fight demons, when she could be tempered in fire. Now she strapped the sword on and left the changing room, picturing how it would be. In her imagination, she was standing on top of the bluffs over the sea at Point Hume, fending off a cadre of Ram demons with Cortana. Julian was with her, of course, wielding his own favorite weapon, the crossbow. In Emma's mind, Jules was always there. Emma had known him for as long as she could remember. The Blackthorns and the Carstairs had always been close, and Jules was only a few months older. She'd literally never lived in a world without him in it. She'd learned to swim in the ocean with him when they'd both been babies. They'd learned to walk together and then run together. She had been carried in his parents' arms and corralled by his older brother and sister when misbehaving. And they'd misbehaved often. Dyeing the puffy white Blackthorn family cat Oscar bright blue had been Emma's idea when they were both 7. Julian had taken the blame anyway. He often did. After all, he'd pointed out she was an only child and he was 1 of 7. His parents would forget they were angry with him a lot more quickly than hers would. She remembered when his mother had died just after Tavi had been born, and how Emma had stood holding Jules's hand while the body had burned in the canyons and the smoke had climbed towards the sky. She remembered that he'd cried, and remembered thinking that boys cried so differently from girls, with awful, ragged sobs that sounded like they were being pulled out with hooks. Maybe it was worse for them because they weren't supposed to cry. Oh! Emma staggered back. She'd been so lost in thought that she plowed right into Julian's father, a tall man with the same tousled brown hair as most of his children. Sorry, Mr. Blackthorn. He grinned. Never seen anyone so eager to get to lessons before, he called as she darted down the hall. The training room was one of Emma's favorite rooms in the whole building. It took up almost an entire level, and both the east and west walls were clear glass. You could see blue sea nearly everywhere you looked. The curve of the coastline was visible from north to south, the endless water of the Pacific stretching out towards Hawaii. In the center of the highly polished wood floor stood the Blackthorn family tutor, a commanding woman named Katerina, currently engaged in teaching knife throwing to the twins. Livy was following instructions obligingly, as she always did, but Ty was scowling and resistant. Julian, in his loose, light training clothes, was lying on his back near the west window, talking to Mark, who had his head stuck in a book and was doing his best to ignore his younger half-brother. Don't you think Mark is kind of a weird name for a shadow hunter? Julian was saying as Emma approached. I mean, if you really think about it, it's confusing. Put a mark on me, Mark. Mark lifted his blonde head from the book he was reading and glared at his younger brother. Julian was idly twirling a steely in his hand. He held it like a paintbrush, something Emma was always scolding him about. You were supposed to hold a steely like a steely as if it were an extension of your hand, not an artist's tool. Mark sighed theatrically. At 16, he was just enough their senior to find everything Emma and Julian did either annoying or ridiculous. If it bothers you, you can call me by my full name, he said. Mark Anthony Blackthorn? Julian wrinkled his nose. It takes a long time to say. What if we got attacked by a demon? By the time I was halfway through saying your name, you'd be dead. In this situation, are you saving my life? Mark asked. Getting ahead of yourself, don't you think, Pipsqueak? It could happen. Julian, not pleased to be called a Pipsqueak, sat up. His hair stuck out in wild tufts all over his head. His older sister Helen was always attacking him with hairbrushes, but it never did any good. He had the Blackthorn hair, like his father and most of his brothers and sisters, wildly wavy, the color of dark chocolate. The family resemblance always fascinated Emma, who looked very little like either of her parents, unless you counted the fact that her father was blonde. Helen had been in Idris for months now with her girlfriend Aline. They had exchanged family rings and they were very serious about each other, according to Emma's parents, which mostly meant they looked at each other in a soppy way. Emma was determined that if she ever fell in love, she would not be soppy in that manner. She understood that there was some amount of fuss about the fact that both Helen and Aline were girls, but she didn't understand why. And the Blackthorn seemed to like Aline a lot. She was a calming presence and kept Helen from fretting. Helen's current absence did mean that no one was cutting Jules's hair, and the sunlight in the room turned the curling tips of it to gold. The windows along the east wall showed the shadowy sweep of the mountains that separated the sea from the San Fernando Valley. Dry, dusty hills riddled with canyons, cacti, and thorn bushes. Sometimes the shadow hunters went outside to train, and Emma loved these moments. loved finding hidden paths and secret waterfalls and the sleepy lizards that rested on the rocks near them. Julian was adept at coaxing the lizards to crawl into his palm and sleep there as he stroked their heads with his thumb. "Watch out!" Emma ducked as a wooden-tipped blade flew by her head and bounced off the window, hitting Mark in the leg on the rebound. He tossed his book down and stood up, scowling. Mark was technically on secondary supervision, backing up Katerina, although he preferred reading to teaching. "Tiberius," Mark said, "do not throw knives at me." "It was an accident." Livy moved to stand between her twin and Mark. Tiberius was as dark as Mark was fair, the only one of the Blackthorns, other than Mark and Helen, who didn't quite count because of their downworlder blood, not to have the brown hair and blue-green eyes that were the family traits. Ty had curly black hair and grey eyes, the colour of iron. "No, it wasn't," said Ty. "I was aiming at you." Mark took an exaggerated deep breath and ran his hands through his hair, which left it sticking up in spikes. Mark had the Blackthorn eyes, the colour of verdigris. But his hair, like Helen's, was pale white blonde as his mother's had been. The rumour was that Mark's mother had been a princess of the Seelie court. She had had an affair with Andrew Blackthorn that had produced two children, whom she'd abandoned on the doorstep of the Los Angeles Institute one night before disappearing forever. Julian's father had taken in his half-fairy children and raised them as shadow hunters. Shadowhunter blood was dominant, and though the council didn't like it, they would accept part downworlder children into the clave as long as their skin could tolerate runes. Both Helen and Mark had been first runed at 10 years old, and their skin held the rune safely, though Emma could tell that being runed hurt Mark more than it hurt an ordinary shadow hunter. She noticed him wincing, though he tried to hide it when the steely was set to his skin. Lately she'd been noticing a lot more things about Mark. The way the odd fairy-influenced shape of his face was appealing and the breadth of his shoulders under his t-shirts. She didn't know why she was noticing those things, and she didn't exactly like it. It made her want to snap at Mark or hide, often at the same time. "You're staring," Julian said, looking at Emma over the knees of his paint-splattered training gear. She snapped back to attention. "At what?" "At Mark, again." He sounded annoyed. "Shut up," Emma hissed under her breath and grabbed for his steely. He grabbed it back and a tussle ensued. Emma giggled as she rolled away from Julian. She'd been training with him for so long she knew every move he'd make before he made it. The only problem was that she was inclined to go too easy on him. The thought of anyone hurting Julian made her furious, and sometimes that included herself. "Is this about the bees in your room?" Mark was demanding as he strode over to Tiberius. "You know why we had to get rid of those." "I assume you did it to thwart me," Ty said. Ty was small for his age, 10, but he had the vocabulary and diction of an 80-year-old. Ty didn't tell lies, usually, mostly because he didn't understand why he might need to. He couldn't understand why some of the things he did annoyed or upset people, and he found that anger either baffling or frightening, depending on his mood. "It's not about thwarting you, Ty. You just can't have bees in your room." "I was studying them," Ty explained, his pale face flushing. "It was important, and they were my friends, and I knew what I was doing."
"Just like you knew what you were doing with a rattlesnake that time," said Mark.
"Sometimes we take things away from you because we don't want you to get hurt. I know it's hard to understand, Ty, but we love you."
Ty looked at him blankly. He knew what "I love you" meant, and he knew it was good, but he didn't understand why it was an explanation for anything. Mark bent down, hands on his knees, keeping his eyes level with Ty's grey ones. "Okay, here's what we're gonna do."
Ha! Emma managed to flip Julian on his back and wrestle his steely away from him. He laughed, wriggling under her until she pinned his arm to the ground. "I give up," he said. "I give..." He was laughing up at her, and she was struck suddenly with the realization that the feeling of lying directly on top of Jules was actually sort of weird, and also the realization that, like Mark, he had a nice shape to his face. Round and boyish and really familiar, but she could almost see through the face he had now to the face he would have when he was older. The sound of the Institute doorbell echoed through the room. It was a deep, sweet chiming noise, like church bells.
From outside, the Institute looked to mundane eyes like the ruins of an old Spanish mission, even though there were private property and keep-out signs posted everywhere. Sometimes people, usually mundanes with a slight dose of the sight, managed to wander up to the front door anyway. Emma rolled off Julian and brushed at her clothes. She had stopped laughing. Julian sat up, propping himself on his hands, his eyes curious. "Everything okay?" he said. "Bang my elbow," she lied, and looked over at the others. Livy was letting Katerina show her how to hold the knife, and Ty was shaking his head at Mark. Ty. She'd been the one to give Tiberius his nickname when he was born, because at 18 months old she hadn't been able to say Tiberius, and called him Ty-Ty instead. Sometimes she wondered if he remembered. It was strange, the things that mattered to Ty and the things that didn't. You couldn't predict them. "Emma?" Julian leaned forward, and everything seemed to explode around them. There was a sudden, enormous flash of light, and the world outside the windows turned white gold and red, as if the Institute had caught fire. At the same time, the floor under them rocked like the deck of a ship. Emma slid forward just as a terrible screaming rose from downstairs, a horrible, unrecognizable scream. Livy gasped and went for Ty, wrapped her arms around him as if she could encircle and protect his body with her own. Livy was one of the very few people Ty didn't mind touching him. He stood with his eyes wide, one of his hands caught in the sleeve of his sister's shirt. Mark had risen to his feet already. Katerina was pale under her coils of dark hair. "You stay here," she said to Emma and Julian, drawing her sword from the sheath at her waist. "Watch the twins. Mark, come with me." "No," Julian said, scrambling to his feet. "Mark..." "I'll be fine, Jules," Mark said with a reassuring smile. He already had a dagger in each hand. He was quick and fast with knives, his aim unerring. "Stay with Emma," he said, nodding towards both of them. And then he vanished after Katerina, the door of the training room shutting behind them. Jules edged closer to Emma, slipped his hand into hers, and helped her to her feet. She wanted to point out to him that she was just fine and could stand on her own, but she let it go. She understood the urge to feel as if you were doing something, anything to help. Another scream suddenly rose from downstairs. There was the sound of glass shattering. Emma hurried across the room towards the twins. They were deadly still, like little statues. Livy was ashen. Ty was clutching her shirt with a death grip. "It's going to be okay," Jules said, putting his hand between his brother's thin shoulder blades. "Whatever it is..." "You have no idea what it is," Ty said in a clipped voice. "You can't say it's going to be okay. You don't know." There was another noise then. It was worse than the sound of a scream. It was a terrible howl, feral and vicious. Werewolves? Emma thought with bewilderment, but she'd heard a werewolf's cry before. This was something much darker and crueler. Livy huddled against Ty's shoulder. He raised his little white face, his eyes tracking from Emma to rest on Julian. "If we hide here," Ty said, "and whatever it is finds us and they hurt our sister, then it's your fault." Livy's face was hidden against Ty. He had spoken softly, but Emma had no doubt he meant it. For all Ty's frightening intellect, for all his strangeness and indifference to other people, he was inseparable from his twin. If Livy was sick, Ty slept at the foot of her bed. If she got a scratch, he panicked, and it was the same the other way round. Emma saw the conflicting emotions chase themselves across Julian's face. His eyes sought hers, and she nodded minutely. The idea of staying in the training room and waiting for whatever had made that sound to come to them made her skin feel as if it were peeling off her bones. Julian strode across the room and then returned with a recurve crossbow and two daggers. "You have to let go of Livy now, Ty," he said, and after a moment the twins separated. Jules handed Livy a dagger and offered the other one to Tiberius, who stared at it as if it were an alien thing. "Ty," Jules said, dropping his hand. "Why did you have the bees in your room? What is it you like about them?" Ty said nothing. "You like the way they work together, right?" Julian said. "Well, we have to work together now. We're going to get to the office and make a call out to the Clave, okay? A distress call, so they'll send backup to protect us." Ty held his hand out for the dagger with a curt nod. "That's what I would have suggested if Mark and Katerina had listened to me." "He would have," Livy said. She had taken the dagger with more confidence than Ty, and held it as if she knew what she was doing with the blade. "It's what he was thinking about." "We're going to have to be very quiet now," Jules said. You two are going to follow me to the office. He raised his eyes. His gaze met Emma's. Emma's going to get Tavi and Drew and meet us there, okay? Emma's heart swooped and plummeted like a seabird. Octavian, Tavi, the baby only 2 years old, and Drew, 8, too young to start physical training. Of course someone was going to have to get them both, and Jules's eyes were pleading. Yes, she said. That's exactly what I'm going to do. Cortana was strapped to Emma's back, a throwing knife in her hand. She thought she could feel the metal pulsing through her veins like a heartbeat as she slipped down the institute corridor, her back to the wall. Every once in a while, the hallway would open out into windows, and the sight of the blue sea and the green mountains and the peaceful white clouds would tease her. She thought of her parents, somewhere out on the beach, having no idea what was happening at the institute. She wished they were here, and at the same time was glad they weren't. At least they were safe. She was in the part of the institute that was most familiar to her now, the family quarters. She slipped past Helen's empty bedroom, clothes packed up and her coverlet dusty, past Julian's room, familiar from a million sleepovers, and Mark's, door firmly shut. The next room was Mr. Blackthorne's, and just beside it was the nursery. Emma took a deep breath and shouldered the door open. The sight that met her eyes in the little blue-painted room made them widen. Tavi was in his crib, his small hands clutching the bars, cheeks bright red from screaming. Drusilla stood in front of the crib, a sword Angel knew as she'd gotten it, clutched in her hand. It was pointed directly at Emma. Drew's hand was shaking enough that the point of the sword was dancing around. Her braid stuck out either side of her plump face, but the look in her Blackthorne eyes was one of steely determination. "Don't you dare touch my brother." "Drew," Emma said as softly as she could. "Drew, it's me. Jules sent me to get you." Drew dropped the sword with a clatter and burst into tears. Emma swept past her and seized the baby out of his crib with her free arm, heaving him up onto her hip. Tavi was small for his age, but still weighed a good 25 pounds. She winced as he clutched onto her hair. "Mema," he said.
"Shush."
She kissed the top of his head. He smelled like baby powder and tears. "Drew, grab onto my belt, okay? We're going to the office. We'll be safe there." Drew took hold of Emma's weapons belt with her small hands. She'd already stopped crying. Shadowhunters didn't cry much, even when they were 8. Emma led the way out into the hall. The sounds from below were worse now. The screams were still going on, the deep howling, the sounds of glass breaking and wood ripping. Emma inched forward, clutching Tavi, murmuring over and over that everything was all right, he'd be all right. And there were more windows, and the sun slashed through them viciously, almost blinding her. She was blinded by panic and the sun. It was the only explanation for the wrong turn she took next. She turned down a corridor, and instead of finding herself in the hallway that she expected, she found herself standing atop the wide staircase that led down to the foyer and the large double doors that were the building's entrance. The foyer was filled with shadowhunters, some familiar to her as the Nephilim of the Los Angeles Conclave, in black, others in red gear. There were rows of statuary, now toppled over in pieces and powder on the ground. The picture window that opened onto the sea had been smashed, and broken glass and blood were everywhere. Emma felt a sick lurch in her stomach. In the middle of the foyer stood a tall figure in scarlet. He was pale blonde, almost white-haired, and his face looked like the carved marble face of Raziel, only entirely without mercy. His eyes were coal black, and in one hand he carried a sword stamped with a pattern of stars. In the other, a goblet made of shimmering adamas. The sight of the cup triggered something in Emma's mind. The adults didn't like to talk about politics around the younger shadowhunters, but she knew that Valentine Morgenstern's son had taken on a different name and sworn vengeance against the Clave. She knew that he had made a cup that was the reverse of the Angel's cup, that changed shadowhunters into evil, demonic creatures. She had heard Mr. Blackthorne call the evil shadowhunters the Endarkened Ones. He had said he'd rather die than be one. This was him, then, Jonathan Morgenstern, whom everyone called Sebastian. A figure out of a fairy tale, a story told to frighten children, come to life. Valentine's son. Emma put a hand to the back of Tavi's head, pressing his face into her shoulder. She couldn't move.
She felt as if lead weights were attached to her feet. All around Sebastian were shadow hunters in black and red and figures in dark cloaks. Were they shadow hunters too? She couldn't tell. Their faces were hidden. And there was Mark, his hands being held behind his back by a shadow hunter in red gear. His daggers lay at his feet and there was blood on his training clothes. Sebastian raised a hand and crooked a long white finger. "Bring her," he said. There was a rustle in the crowd, and Mr. Blackthorne stepped forward, dragging Katerina with him. She was fighting, beating at him with her hands, but he was too strong. Emma watched in disbelieving horror as Mr. Blackthorne pushed her to her knees. "Now," said Sebastian in a voice like silk, "drink of the infernal cup." And he forced the rim of the cup between Katerina's teeth. That was when Emma found out what the terrible howling noise she had heard before was. Katerina tried to fight free, but Sebastian was too strong. He jammed the cup past her lips, and Emma saw her gasp and swallow. She wrenched away, and this time Mr. Blackthorne let her. He was laughing, and so was Sebastian. Katerina fell to the ground, her body spasming, and from her throat came a single scream, worse than a scream, a howl of pain, as if her soul were being torn out of her body. A laugh went around the room. Sebastian smiled. There was something horrible and beautiful about him. The way there was something horrible and beautiful about poisonous snakes and great white sharks. He was flanked by two companions, Emma realized. A woman with graying brown hair, an axe in her hands, and a tall figure wrapped entirely in a black cloak. No part of him was visible except the dark boots that showed beneath the hem of his robe. Only his height and breadth made her think he was a man at all. "Is that the last of the shadow hunters here?" Sebastian asked.
"There is the boy, Mark Blackthorne," said the woman, standing beside him, raising a finger and pointing at Mark. "He ought to be old enough."
Sebastian looked down at Katerina, who had stopped her spasming and lay still, her dark hair tangled across her face. "Get up, Sister Katerina," he said. "Go and bring Mark Blackthorne to me." Emma watched, rooted to the spot, as Katerina rose slowly to her feet. Katerina had been the tutor at the Institute for as long as Emma could remember. She had been their teacher when Tavi had been born, when Jules' mother had died, when Emma had first started physical training. She had taught them languages and bound up cuts and soothed scrapes and given them their first weapons. She had been like family. And now she stepped, blank-eyed, across the mess on the floor and reached out to seize Mark. Drew gave a gasp, snapping Emma back to consciousness. Emma whirled and placed Tavi in Drew's arms. Drew staggered a little and then recovered, clutching her baby brother tight. "Run," Emma said. "Run to the office. Tell Julian I'll be right there." Something of the urgency in Emma's voice communicated itself. Drusilla didn't argue, just clutched Tavi more tightly and fled, her bare little feet soundless on the corridor floors. Emma spun back to stare down at the unfolding horror. Katerina was behind Mark, pushing him ahead, a dagger pressed to the space between his shoulder blades. He staggered and nearly stumbled in front of Sebastian. Mark was closer to the steps now, and Emma could see that he had been fighting. There were defensive wounds on his wrists and hands, cuts on his face, and there had doubtless been no time for healing wounds. There was blood all over his right cheek. Sebastian looked at him, lip curling in annoyance. "This one is not all Nephilim," he said. "Heart fairy, am I correct? Why was I not informed?" There was a murmur. The brown-haired woman said,
"Does it mean the cup will not work on him, Lord Sebastian?"
"It means I don't want him," said Sebastian.
"We could take him to the Valley of Salt," said the brown-haired woman, "or to the high places of Edom, and sacrifice him there for the pleasure of Asmodeus and Lilith."
"No," Sebastian said slowly. "No, it would not be wise, I think, to do that to one with the blood of the fair folk." Mark spat at him. Sebastian looked startled. He turned to Julian's father. "Come and restrain him," he said. "Wound him if you desire. I shall have only so much patience with your half-breed son." Mr. Blackthorne stepped forward, holding a broadsword. The blade was already stained with blood. Mark's eyes widened with terror.
The sword rose up. The throwing knife left Emma's hand. It flew through the air and buried itself in Sebastian Morgenstern's chest. Sebastian staggered back, and Mr. Blackthorne's sword hand fell to his side. The others were crying out. Mark leapt to his feet as Sebastian looked down at the blade in his chest, its handle protruding from his heart. He frowned. "Ouch," he said, and pulled the knife free. The blade was slick with blood, but Sebastian himself looked unbothered by the injury. He cast the weapon aside, staring upward. Emma felt those dark, empty eyes on her like the touch of cold fingers. She felt him take the measure of her, sum her up and know her and dismiss her. "It's a shame you won't live," he said to her. "Live to tell the Clave that Lilith has strengthened me beyond all measure. Perhaps a Glorious could end my life. A pity for the Nephilim that they have no more favors they can ask of heaven, and none of the puny instruments of war they forge in their adamant citadel can harm me now." He turned to the others. "Kill the girl," he demanded, flicking at his now bloody jacket with distaste. Emma saw Mark lunge for the stairs, trying to get to her first, but the dark figure at Sebastian's side had already seized Mark and was drawing him backward with black-gloved hands. Those arms went around Mark, held him, almost as if protecting him. Mark was struggling, and then he was lost to Emma's view as the Andarkan surged up the steps. Emma turned and ran. She had learned to run on the beaches of California, where the sand shifted under her feet with every step. So on solid ground, she was as fast as the wind. She hurtled down the hall, her hair flying out behind her, leaped and jumped down a short set of steps, spun to the right and burst into the office. She slammed the door behind her and threw the bolt before turning to stare. The office was a sizable room, the walls lined with reference books. There was another library on the top floor as well, but this was where Mr. Blackthorne had run the institute. There was his mahogany desk, and on it two telephones, one white and one black. The receiver was off the hook on the black phone, and Julian was holding the handset, shouting down the line. "You have to keep the portal open. We're not all safe yet, please." The door behind Emma boomed and echoed as the Andarkand threw themselves against it. Julian looked up with alarm, and the receiver fell from his fingers as he saw Emma. She stared back at him and passed him to where the whole eastern wall was glowing. In the center was a portal, a rectangular-shaped hole in the wall through which Emma could see whirling silver shapes, a chaos of clouds and wind. She staggered toward Julian, and he caught her by the shoulders. His fingers gripped her skin tightly, as if he couldn't believe she was there or real. "Emma," he breathed, and then his voice picked up speed. "And where's Mark? Where's my father?" She shook her head. "They can't. I couldn't." She swallowed. "It's Sebastian Morgenstern," she said, and winced as the door shuddered again under another assault. "We have to go back for them," she said, turning, but Julian's hand was already around her wrist. "The portal," he shouted over the sound of the wind and the battering at the door. "It goes to Idris. The Clave opened it. Emma, it's going to stay open for only another few seconds." "But Mark," she said, though she had no idea what they could do, how they could fight their way past the Andarkand crowding the hallway, how they could defeat Sebastian Morgenstern, who was more powerful than any ordinary shadow hunter. "We have to..." "Emma," Julian shouted, and then the door burst open, and the Andarkand poured into the room. She heard the brown-haired woman shrieking after her, something about how the Nephilim would burn. They would all burn in the fires of Edom. They would all burn and die and be destroyed. Julian bolted toward the portal, dragging Emma by one hand. After one terrified look behind her, she let him pull her along. She ducked as an arrow sailed past them and smashed through a window on her right. Julian seized her frantically, wrapping his arms around her. She felt his fingers knot into the back of her shirt as they fell forward into the portal and were swallowed up by the tempest.
Part 1. Bring forth a fire. "Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. It shall devour thee, and I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth, in the sight of all them that behold thee. All they that know thee among the people shall be astonished at thee. Thou shalt be a terror. and never shalt thou be any more. Ezekiel 28:14. 1. The portion of their cup. Picture something calming. The beach in Los Angeles. White sand. Crashing blue water. You're strolling along the tide line. Jace cracked an eye open. This sounds very romantic. The boy sitting across from him sighed and ran his hands through his shaggy dark hair. Though it was a cold December day, werewolves didn't feel weather as acutely as humans, and Jordan had his jacket off and his shirt sleeves rolled up. They were seated opposite each other on a patch of browning grass in a clearing in Central Park, both cross-legged, their hands on their knees, palms up. An outcropping of rock rose from the ground near them. It was broken up into larger and smaller boulders, and atop one of the larger boulders perched Alec and Isabel Lightwood. As Jace looked up, Isabel caught his eye and gave him an encouraging wave. Alec, noting her gesture, smacked her shoulder. Jace could see him lecturing Izzy, probably about not breaking Jace's concentration. He smiled to himself. Neither of them really had a reason to be here, but they had come anyway for moral support. Though, Jace suspected it had more to do with the fact that Alec hated to be at loose ends these days, Isabel hated for her brother to be on his own, and both of them were avoiding their parents and the Institute. Jordan snapped his fingers under Jace's nose. "Are you paying any attention?" Jace frowned. "I was, until we wandered into the territory of bad personal ads." "Well, what kind of thing does make you feel calm and peaceful?" Jace took his hands off his knees, the lotus position was giving him wrist cramps, and leaned back on his arms. Chilly wind rattled the few dead leaves that still clung to the branches of the trees. Against the pale winter sky, the leaves had a spare elegance, like pen and ink sketches. "Killing demons," he said. "A good clean kill is very relaxing. The messy ones are more annoying because you have to clean up afterward." "No!" Jordan held his hands up. Below the sleeves of his shirt, the tattoos that wrapped his arms were visible. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Jace knew it meant the peace that passes understanding, and that you were supposed to say the word 3 times every time you uttered the mantra to calm your mind. But nothing seemed to calm his these days. The fire in his veins made his mind race too, thoughts coming too quickly, one after another, like exploding fireworks. Dreams as vivid and saturated with color as oil paintings. He'd tried training it out of himself, hours and hours spent in the practice room, blood and bruises and sweat, and once, even, broken fingers. But he hadn't managed to do much more than irritate Alec with requests for healing runes and, on one memorable occasion, accidentally set fire to one of the crossbeams. It was Simon who had pointed out that his roommate meditated every day, and who'd said that learning the habit was what had calmed the uncontrollable fits of rage that were often part of the transformation into a werewolf. From there, it had been a short jump to Clary, suggesting that Jace might as well try it, and here they were at his second session. The first session had ended with Jace burning a mark into Simon and Jordan's hardwood floor, so Jordan had suggested they take it outside for the second round to prevent further property damage. "No killing," Jordan said. "We're trying to make you feel peaceful. Blood, killing, war, those are all non-peaceful things. Isn't there anything else you like?"
"Weapons," said Jace. "I like weapons."
"I'm starting to think we have a problematic issue of personal philosophy here." Jace leaned forward, his palms flat on the grass.
"I'm a warrior," he said.
"I was brought up as a warrior. I didn't have toys, I had weapons. I slept with a wooden sword until I was 5. My first books were medieval demonologies with illuminated pages. The first songs I learned were chants to banish demons. I know what brings me peace, and it isn't sandy beaches or chirping birds in rainforests. I want a weapon in my hand, and a strategy to win."
Jordan looked at him levelly.
"So you're saying what brings you peace is war?" Jace threw his hands up and stood, brushing grass off his jeans.
"Now you get it."
He heard the crackle of dry grass and turned in time to see Clary duck through a gap between 2 trees and emerge into the clearing, Simon only a few steps behind her.
Clary had her hands in her back pockets, and she was laughing. Jace watched them for a moment. There was something about looking at people who didn't know they were being watched. He remembered the second time he had ever seen Clary, across the main room of Java Jones. She'd been laughing and talking with Simon the way she was doing now. He remembered the unfamiliar twist of jealousy in his chest, pressing out his breath, the feeling of satisfaction when she'd left Simon behind to come and talk to him. Things did change. He'd gone from being eaten up with jealousy of Simon to a grudging respect for his tenacity and courage, to actually considering him a friend, though he doubted he'd ever say so out loud. Jace watched as Clary looked over and blew him a kiss, her red hair bouncing in its ponytail. She was so small, delicate, doll-like, he had once thought, before he'd learned how strong she was. She headed toward Jason Jordan, leaving Simon to scamper up the rocky ground to where Alec and Isabel were sitting. He collapsed beside Isabel, who immediately leaned over to say something to him, her black curtain of hair hiding her face. Clary stopped in front of Jace, rocking back on her heels with a smile. "How's it coming along?" "Jordan wants me to think about the beach," Jace said gloomily. "He's stubborn," Clary said to Jordan. "What he means is that he appreciates it." "I don't, really," said Jace. Jordan snorted. "Without me, you'd be bouncing down Madison Avenue, shooting sparks out of all your orifices." He rose to his feet, shrugging on his green jacket. "Your boyfriend's crazy," he said to Clary. "Yeah, but he's hot," said Clary. "So there's that." Jordan made a face, but it was good-natured. "I'm heading out," he said. "Gotta meet Maya downtown." He gave a mock salute and was gone, slipping into the trees and vanishing with the silent tread of the wolf he was under the skin. Jace watched him go. "Unlikely saviors," he thought. 6 months ago, he wouldn't have believed anyone who'd told him he was going to wind up taking behavioral lessons from a werewolf. Jordan and Simon and Jace had struck up something of a friendship in the past months. Jace couldn't help using their apartment as a refuge, away from the daily pressures of the Institute, away from the reminders that the Clave was still unprepared for war with Sebastian. Erhome. The word brushed the back of Jace's mind like the touch of a feather, making him shiver. He saw an angel's wing, torn from its body, lying in a pool of golden blood. "I am coming."
"What's wrong?" Clary said. Jace suddenly looked a million miles away. Since the heavenly fire had entered his body, he tended to drift off more into his head. She had a feeling that it was a side effect of suppressing his emotions. She felt a little pang. Jace, when she had met him, had been so controlled, only a little of his real self leaking out through the cracks in his personal armor, like light through the chinks in a wall. It had taken a long time to break down those defenses. Now, though, the fire in his veins was forcing him to put them back up, to bite down on his emotions for safety's sake. But when the fire was gone, would he be able to dismantle them again? He blinked, called back by her voice. The winter sun was high and cold. It sharpened the bones of his face and threw the shadows under his eyes into relief. He reached for her hand, taking a deep breath. "You're right," he said in the quiet, more serious voice he reserved only for her. "It is helping, the lessons with Jordan. It is helping, and I do appreciate it." "I know." Clary curled her hand around his wrist. His skin felt warm under her touch. He seemed to run several degrees hotter than normal since his encounter with Glorious. His heart still pounded its familiar steady rhythm, but the blood being pushed through his veins seemed to thrum under her touch with the kinetic energy of a fire just about to catch. She went up on her toes to kiss his cheek, but he turned and their lips brushed. They'd done nothing more than kiss since the fire had first started singing in his blood, and they'd done even that carefully. Jace was careful now, his mouth sliding softly against hers, his hand closing on her shoulder. For a moment they were body to body, and she felt the thrum and pulse of his blood. He moved to pull her closer, and a sharp, dry spark passed between them, like the zing of static electricity.
Jace broke off the kiss and stepped back with an exhale. Before Clary could say anything, a chorus of sarcastic applause broke out from the nearby hill. Simon, Isabel, and Alec waved at them. Jace bowed, while Clary stepped back slightly sheepishly, hooking her thumbs into the belt of her jeans. Jace sighed. Shall we join our annoying voyeuristic friends? Unfortunately, that's the only kind of friends we have. Clary bumped her shoulder against his arm and they headed up towards the rocks. Simon and Isabel were side by side talking quietly. Alec was sitting a little apart, staring at the screen of his phone with an expression of intense concentration. Jace threw himself down next to his parabatai. I've heard that if you stare at those things enough, they'll ring. He's been texting Magnus, said Isabel, glancing over with a disapproving look. I haven't, Alec said automatically. Yes, you have, said Jace, craning to look over Alec's shoulder. And calling, I can see your outgoing calls. It's his birthday, Alec said, flipping the phone shut. He looked smaller these days, almost skinny in his worn blue pullover, holes at the elbows, his lips bitten and chapped. Clary's heart went out to him. He'd spent the first week after Magnus had broken up with him in a sort of daze of sadness and disbelief. None of them could really believe it. She'd always thought Magnus loved Alec, really loved him. Clearly, Alec had thought so too. I didn't want him to think that I didn't, to think that I forgot. You're pining, said Jace. Alec shrugged. Look who's talking. Oh, I love her. Oh, she's my sister. Oh, why? Jace threw a handful of dead leaves at Alec, making him splutter. Isabel was laughing. You know he's right, Jace. Give me your phone, Jace said, ignoring Isabel. Come on, Alexander. It's none of your business, Alec said, holding the phone away. Just forget about it, okay? You don't eat, you don't sleep, you stare at your phone and I'm supposed to forget about it, Jace said. There was a surprising amount of agitation in his voice. Clary knew how upset he'd been that Alec was unhappy, but she wasn't sure Alec knew it. Under normal circumstances, Jace would have killed or at least threatened anyone who hurt Alec. This was different. Jace liked to win, but you couldn't win out over a broken heart, even someone else's, even someone you loved. Jace leaned over and grabbed the phone out of his parabatai's hand. Alec protested and reached for it, but Jace held him off with one hand, expertly scrolling through the messages on the phone with the other. Magnus, just call me back. I need to know if you're okay. He shook his head. Okay, no, just, no. With a decisive move, he snapped the phone in half. The screen went blank as Jace dropped the pieces to the ground. There. Alec looked down at the shattered pieces in disbelief. You broke my phone! Jace shrugged. Guys, don't let other guys keep calling other guys. Okay, that came out wrong. Friends don't let friends keep calling their exes and hanging up. Seriously, you have to stop. Alec looked furious. So you broke my brand new phone. Thanks a lot. Jace smiled serenely and lay back on the rock. You're welcome. Look on the bright side, Isabel said. You won't be able to get texts from Mum anymore. She's texted me 6 times today. I turned my phone off. She patted her pocket with a significant look. What does she want? Simon asked. Constant meetings, Isabel said. Depositions. The Clave keeps wanting to hear what happened when we fought Sebastian at the Burren. We've all had to give accounts like 50 times. How Jace absorbed the heavenly fire from Glorious. Descriptions of the Dark Shadow Hunters, the Infernal Cup, the weapons they used, the runes that were on them, what we were wearing, what Sebastian was wearing, what everyone was wearing. Like phone sex, but boring. Simon made a choking noise. What we think Sebastian wants, Alec added. When he'll come back, what he'll do when he does. Clary leaned her elbows on her knees. Always good to know the Clave has a well-thought-out and reliable plan. They don't want to believe it, said Jace, staring at the sky. That's the problem. No matter how many times we tell them what we saw at the Burren, no matter how many times we tell them how dangerous the Endarkened are, they don't want to believe that Nephilim could really be corrupted, that Shadow Hunters could kill Shadow Hunters. Clary had been there when Sebastian had created the first of the Endarkened. She had seen the blankness in their eyes, the fury with which they fought. They terrified her. They're not Shadow Hunters anymore, she added in a low voice. They're not people. It's hard to believe that if you haven't seen it, Alex said. And Sebastian has only so many of them. A small force, scattered. They don't want to believe he's really a threat. Or if he is a threat, they'd rather believe it was more a threat to us, to New York, than to shadow hunters at large. They're not wrong that if Sebastian cares about anything, it's about Clary, Jace said, and Clary felt a cold shiver at her spine, a mixture of disgust and apprehension. He doesn't really have emotions, not like we do. But if he did, he'd have them about her. And he has them about Jocelyn. He hates her. He paused, thoughtful. But I don't think he'd be likely to strike directly here. Too obvious. I hope you told the Clave this, Simon said. About 1,000 times, said Jace. I don't think they hold my insights in particularly high regard. Clary looked down at her hands. She had been deposed by the Clave, just like the rest of them. She'd given answers to all their questions. There were still things about Sebastian she hadn't told them. Hadn't told anyone. The things he'd said he wanted from her. She hadn't dreamed much since they'd come back from the Burren with Jace's veins full of fire. But when she did have nightmares, they were about her brother. It's like trying to fight a ghost, Jace said. They can't track Sebastian, they can't find him, they can't find the shadow hunters he's turned. They're doing what they can, Alex said. They're shoring up the wards around Idris and Alicante. All the wards, in fact. They've sent dozens of experts to Wrangle Island. Wrangle Island was the seat of all the world's wards, the spells that protected the globe, and Idris in particular, from demons and demon invasion. The network of wards wasn't perfect, and demons slipped through sometimes anyway, but Clary could only imagine how bad the situation would get if the wards didn't exist. I heard Mum say that the warlocks of the Spiral Labyrinth have been looking for a way to reverse the effects of the Infernal Cup, said Isabel. Of course it would be easier if they had bodies to study. She trailed off. Clary knew why. The bodies of the Dark Shadow Hunters killed at the Burren had been brought back to the Bone City for the Silent Brothers to examine. The brothers had never gotten the chance. Overnight, the bodies had rotted away to the equivalent of decade-old corpses. There had been nothing to do but burn the remains. Isabel found her voice again. And the Iron Sisters are churning out weapons. We're getting thousands more seraph blades, swords, chakrams, everything forged in heavenly fire. She looked at Jace. In the days immediately following the battle at the Burren, when the fire had raged through Jace's veins violently enough to make him scream sometimes with the pain, the Silent Brothers had examined him over and over, had tested him with ice and flame, with blessed metal and cold iron, trying to see if there was some way to draw the fire out of him to contain it. They hadn't found one. The fire of Glorious, having once been captured in a blade, seemed in no hurry to inhabit another, or indeed to leave Jace's body for any kind of vessel. Brother Zachariah had told Clary that in the earliest days of Shadowhunters, the Nephilim had sought to capture heavenly fire in a weapon, something that could be wielded against demons. They had never managed it, and eventually seraph blades had become their weapons of choice. In the end, again, the Silent Brothers had given up. Glorious's fire lay curled in Jace's veins like a serpent, and the best he could hope for was to control it so that it didn't destroy him. The loud beep of a text message sounded. Isabel had flicked on her phone again. "Mum says to get back to the Institute now," she said. "There's some meeting. We have to be at it." She stood up, brushing dirt from her dress. "I'd invite you back," she said to Simon. "But, you know, banned for being undead and all."
"I did remember that," Simon said, getting to his feet.
Clary scrambled up and reached a hand down to Jace. He took it and stood.
"Simon and I are going Christmas shopping," she said. "And none of you can come because we have to get you presents."
Alec looked horrified.
"Oh, God, does that mean I have to get you guys presents?"
Clary shook her head.
"Don't shadow hunters do, you know, Christmas?"
She thought back suddenly to the rather distressing Thanksgiving dinner at Luke's when Jace, on being asked to carve the turkey, had laid into the bird with a sword until there had been little left but turkey flakes. Maybe not?
"We exchange gifts. We honor the change of the seasons," said Isabel. "There used to be a winter celebration of the angel. It observed the day that the mortal instruments were given to Jonathan Shadowhunter. I think Shadowhunters got annoyed with being left out of all the mundane celebrations, though, so a lot of institutes have Christmas parties. The London one is famous, she shrugged. I just don't think we're going to do it this year. Oh. Clary felt awful. Of course they didn't want to celebrate Christmas after losing Max. Well, let us get you presents at least. There doesn't have to be a party or anything like that. Exactly. Simon threw his arms up. I have to buy Hanukkah presents. It's mandated by Jewish law. The God of the Jews is an angry God, and very gift-oriented. Clary smiled at him. He was finding it easier and easier to say the word God these days. Jace sighed and kissed Clary, a quick goodbye brush of lips against her temple, but it made her shiver. Not being able to touch Jace or kiss him properly was starting to make her jump out of her own skin. She'd promised him it would never matter, that she'd love him even if they could never touch again, but she hated it anyway. Hated missing the reassurance of the way they had always fit together physically. See you later, Jace said. I'm going to head back with Alec and Izzy. No, you're not, Isabel said unexpectedly. You broke Alec's phone. Granted, we've all been wanting to do that for weeks. Isabel, Alec said. But the fact is, you're his parabatai, and you're the only one who hasn't been to see Magnus. Go talk to him. And tell him what? Jay said. You can't talk people into not breaking up with you. Or maybe you can, he added hastily at Alec's expression. Who can say? I'll give it a try. Thanks, Alec clapped Jace on the shoulder. I've heard you can be charming when you want to be. I've heard the same, Jace said, breaking into a backward jog. He was even graceful doing that, Clary thought gloomily. And sexy, definitely sexy. She lifted her hand in a half-hearted wave. See you later, she called. If I'm not dead from frustration by then. The Freys had never been a religiously observant family, but Clary loved Fifth Avenue at Christmas time. The air smelled like sweet roasted chestnuts and the window displays sparkled with silver and blue, green and red. This year there were fat, round crystal snowflakes attached to each lamppost, sending back the winter sunlight in shafts of gold. Not to mention the huge tree at Rockefeller Center. It threw its shadow across them when she and Simon draped themselves over the gate at the side of the skating rink, watching tourists fall down as they tried to navigate the ice. Clary had a hot chocolate wrapped in her hands, the warmth spreading through her body. She felt almost normal. This, coming to Fifth to see the window displays and the tree, had been a winter tradition for her and Simon for as long as she could remember. Feels like old times, doesn't it? He said, echoing her thoughts as he propped his chin on his folded arms. She chanced a sideways look at him. He was wearing a black top coat and scarf that emphasized the pallor of his skin. His eyes were shadowed, indicating that he hadn't fed on blood recently. He looked like what he was, a hungry, tired vampire. Well, she thought, almost like old times. More people to buy presents for, she said. Plus the always traumatic what to buy someone for the first Christmas after you started dating question. What to get the shadow hunter who has everything, Simon said with a grin. Jace mostly likes weapons, Clary said. He likes books, but they have a huge library at the Institute. He likes classical music? She brightened. Simon was a musician, even though his band was terrible and was always changing their name. Currently, they were Lethal Soufflé. He did have training. What would you give someone who likes to play the piano? A piano? Simon? A really huge metronome that could also double as a weapon? Clary sighed, exasperated. Sheet music. Rachmaninoff is tough stuff, but he likes a challenge. Good idea. I'm going to see if there's a music store around here. Clary, done with her hot chocolate, tossed the cup into a nearby trash can and pulled her phone out. What about you? What are you giving Isabel? I have absolutely no idea, Simon said. They had started heading towards the avenue, where a steady stream of pedestrians gawking at the windows clogged the streets. Oh, come on, Isabel's easy. That's my girlfriend you're talking about, Simon's brows drew together. I think, I'm not sure we haven't discussed it. The relationship, I mean. You really have to DTR, Simon. What?
Define the relationship, what it is, where it's going. Are you boyfriend and girlfriend, just having fun? It's complicated, or what? When's she going to tell her parents? Are you allowed to see other people? Simon blanched. What, seriously? Seriously. In the meantime, perfume.